Last Sunday, a shootout between rival motorcycle gangs in Waco, Texas, left 9 dead, 18 injured, with 170 arrests. The rival gangs converged in the parking lot of a Twin Peaks restaurant, and as violence broke out, police were reportedly shot at, and they returned fire.
The violence comes at a time when the national media has been focused on police interactions with black communities, and directly on the heels in Baltimore, on the riots, rather, in Baltimore, that were heavily covered by the press.
Some critics have pointed to the police response and media coverage of the Waco, Texas violence as an example of how racial bias persists in the work of police and media, that on the whole, white-on-white crime is treated differently than black-on-black crime in American society. Jesse Holland joins us now. He's a race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Later, we'll be joined by Rutgers communications professor Aram Sinreich. Jesse Holland, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, can you give us a recap of the events of that day? What happened in that parking lot in Waco?
Well, from what we've been able to tell so far, there was a meeting of motorcycle clubs at the Twin Peaks restaurant in Waco, Texas. Police had already been alerted that this meeting was going on, and so a SWAT team was already there. And the details are differing, but right now what the police are saying is that an uninvited motorcycle club or gang, motorcycle gang, had shown up at this restaurant, and a fight broke out, and the police got involved, and 9 people were fatally shot. There's still some discussion, because the preliminary autopsies have not been released yet, of actually who shot who. We don't know whether it was bikers who fatally shot bikers or police who fatally shot bikers. But what we do know is that 9 people are dead, 170 people have been arrested, and each one of them that had been arrested is on $1 million bond.
Now, this is important to the story we're telling about media coverage. What was the demographic makeup, from what we know anyway, of the bikers involved and arrested?
From what we have seen from mugshots, the majority of the people involved were white male. There were some Hispanic males, and there were some African-American-looking bikers there as well. And there were women. But from what we've seen from the mugshots released by the police, the majority of the people there look white.
Now, you, in a piece, looked at response to police action and to media coverage. And some people you quoted were focusing on what the scene of the shootout looked like after things had settled down. Can you describe those scenes that people have been reacting to?
Yes. Several commentators, including TV1's Roland Martin, and several other people who looked at the images coming out of Waco, saw images of police officers standing around looking nonchalant while bikers, who we assume were later arrested, were able to use their cell phones. And they compared those pictures to pictures from Baltimore, where you had police in riot gear confronting protesters and looters. And the question came up of why was the police response in Waco seemingly so mild when the police response in Baltimore seemed so excessive? Now, obviously, these are two different situations. The situations in Waco happened over a matter of minutes and was over. The situation in Baltimore went on for days. So there was obviously, there's no way you can make an apple-to-apple comparison. But some people looked at those images and wondered, why was the police response seemingly one way in Waco and another way in Baltimore?
Talking to Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, comparing reactions to what happened in Waco, Texas, people drawing comparisons between police response and media response to that incident, this biker gang shootout in Waco, comparing it to things like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, and elsewhere. Now, on the journalistic side, Jesse, some of the criticism has been in about how journalists used words, and pundits, for that matter. Thugs, the word thug deployed when there was black involved violence or rioting, the word rioting used there, but not in Waco. What have people been saying about that compare and contrast there?
Well, one of the things that most people focus on when they look at journalism, they don't focus on the news stories. They focus on the columnists, the commentators. And what a lot of people saw from the commentators behind Baltimore was that the protesters, some of whom were violent, but a lot of whom were not, were immediately castigated in the media and called thugs and criminals. Even President Obama used the word thugs when he talked about the violence going on in Baltimore. However, when you have Waco, you had people who called them criminals, but then did not go any further than that. The people in Waco were not immediately stereotyped and castigated in the same way that the people in Baltimore were. And some commentators and some media critics, there was at least one newspaper did a editorial cartoon wondering why there wasn't the same outcry about societal concerns and poverty and families behind the Waco incident, which, by the way, ended in fatalities, as there were in Baltimore, which ended in no fatalities.
So in your own writing about this piece you wrote, I was looking at the comments you got in reaction. Not surprisingly, there's a strong partisan divide in this country. These issues are divisive. A lot of response, angry, heated response. What kind of things were you seeing in response to your reporting?
Oh, we always get... That's when you know you've written a story that has actually touched a nerve, is when you get the angry responses. I've been getting tons of both positive and negative comments on this story. One of the things that I've learned as a journalist is that a lot of people confuse the message with the messenger. What I did was write a story about a conversation that's going on in the African-American community, and a lot of people have taken that to be something that I think is going on, instead of something that I'm reporting, a conversation that I'm reporting that's happening. Now, this conversation is going on, and it's been going on for a while, but a lot of these conversations don't ever make it into the general public's view. This is one conversation that has. So it's bringing out a lot of passionate responses from a lot of different readers, which I love, which means that they're actually reading the story, that people are actually talking about this issue. And conversation is one way we can help end a lot of problems in America.
Jesse, you write about, as we said, race and ethnicity issues. You've written about various attitudes toward policing in the past, this current story now. As you're covering this stuff, do you sometimes second-guess yourself or think, why am I choosing that word instead of this word? How much second-guessing goes on?
Well, as a journalist, you should always be careful with every word that you use, because our stories have impact. So I always second-guess everything I write, even as it's being written, and then even more after it's published. Because as a journalist, it's your job to be as fair and present things as fairly as you can. So I always question what I do, and I always read everything that people send me about my stories, because there might always be a point of view that I don't know. So you always work hard to make sure that everything you write, every word you use, is the correct one. And we do a lot of that at Associated Press. We have editors whose job is only to read those stories and make sure we're using the appropriate words. So we do a lot of fact-checking and content checking to be sure that the words that we use are the correct ones for the situations that we put them in.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, talking about criticism of possible racial bias in police and media responses to this biker gang shootout last weekend in Waco, Texas. Coming up, we'll hear more from a communications professor about potential media bias in particular.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the media and society at large respond differently to violence committed by white people compared with violence committed by black people? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
We're talking about whether the media has a racial bias and how it covers crime committed by white people compared with crime committed by black people in the wake of the biker gang shootout in Waco, Texas. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We just heard from Jesse Holland, race and ethnicity writer at the Associated Press. Now we're joined by Aram Sinreich, assistant professor at Rutgers University's School of Communication and Information. Aram, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So based on what you've seen, do you think the media coverage of these shootings in Waco is an example of some kind of racial bias, conscious or unconscious, in the media?
I do, unfortunately, and I think it's largely unconscious. And it's a very complex problem that media and communication scholars have spent decades and reams of paper trying to address. And unfortunately, it's not the kind of thing that we can fix with a silver bullet. But being aware of it and having the kind of conversation that we're having now and inviting on, you know, self-conscious journalists like Jesse Holland to explain how they approach their practice, I think is a very good first step.
So on an unconscious level, so how does that work? Is it that, you know, the media has these narratives in their mind and they fit the story to it based on what they're seeing? What happens there behind the words?
That's a great question. So there are a number of different mechanisms at work here. And at the most basic, I think a major problem is that we don't really have newsrooms that reflect the diversity of the American public at large. Right, even today, and you know, well into the second term of America's first African American president, 90% of the people working in a newspaper newsroom are white. 92% of the guests invited to opine on Sunday television talk shows are white. 98% of the owners of television news stations are white. So, at a very fundamental level, you have a lack of diversity of viewpoint being caused by a lack of diversity of background among the people responsible for generating and disseminating and framing the news stories. And then from there on, there are more complex problems. Like, as you say, you know, language has a way of insinuating itself into the way that we think. And the more that we tell ourselves, and I mean that collectively as a nation, that, you know, black people committing violence collectively are thugs, whereas white people committing violence collectively are criminals, or that, you know, black people out on the street is a riot, whereas white people out on the street with guns is a shootout. The more we kind of segregate the language that we use to describe these scenarios, the more prone we are to reflexively repeat that segregation in our own language. And then, of course, you know, those linguistic rifts emerge into social rifts and drive us further apart as a nation.
Well, I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think there definitely are some differences, but it's really hard to compare, like your previous guest. That was just terrible, terrible comparison. It's like comparing Girl Scouts to ISIS. It's ridiculous. But there are most certainly a certain amount of racism going on in this country. We know it. It's blatant. It happens every day. But once again, there's not – name the last time that there was a large group of all whites that went through their neighborhood and looted and trashed their businesses, and then the following week complained that they had no businesses left in their neighborhood. It's really tough to compare.
This actually happens fairly frequently. You know, they were just riots having to do with a major sporting event a few months ago, which was largely white-driven riots. That led to the destruction of thousands of dollars in property. There was a big riot over Halloween a year or two ago, and pumpkins were a big element of that story. The problem is that when these things happen, when young white people take to the streets and commit violence, either for political reasons or for cultural reasons, they're looked at and framed in the media as miscreants. You know, oh, these kids are just no good, or these kids just made a mistake. And when black people do the same thing, the entire African-American community is held accountable for their actions. And there's this public outrage about the, you know, the influence of hip-hop music and about, you know, what about, you know, all these single-parent families. And you know, there's this notion that African-Americans are doing this to themselves, are somehow culpable for the actions of the members of their groups, whereas there's no equivalent hand-wringing over single-parent white families, or poverty in the white community, or, you know, white power as an ideology when people from a European background do the same kinds of things.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. I mean, another criticism kind of along those lines in this particular instance is with this Waco shootout, whatever we want to call it, this is definitely a distinct criminal element. This is a different criminal organizations all in one place at the same time, whereas watching coverage of what we've called riots in other cities, it looks like, at least from the coverage we see, members of the community at large. Is that a fair comparison, first of all? Is this apples and oranges?
Oh, it's definitely apples and oranges, but I think it's an apples and oranges that highlights rather than detracts from the kind of analysis that you're trying to do in this story. I mean, from at every level, you know, the police were more courteous and considerate to the Waco shooters than they were to the Baltimore protesters. Even though the Waco shooters were criminals and drug dealers and, you know, had hundreds of weapons, and the Baltimore protesters were largely nonviolent civilians standing up for their civil rights, right? So there's a disparity in terms of how the police react. There was no riot gear used in Waco. There was no National Guard called in. There was no kind of proactive fencing off of area. I mean, there was a little bit of effort by the police to go in and try to make peace, but even that distinguishes itself. So the fact, I mean, if we were comparing a shootout between the Crips and the Bloods to a shootout between these motorcycle gangs, that would be a more apples-to-apples comparison. But the fact that things went so much worse for the Baltimore protesters than they did for the Waco criminals even highlights the disparities in terms of our racial attitudes in this country. So there's the police treatment, and then there's the media framing. You know, these are still, when nonviolent protesters who are African American take to the streets in Ferguson or in Baltimore, as I said before, the news media tends to focus on, you know, the social pathologies that they believe led to these people embracing violence. And when people actually commit violence, premeditated collective murder in Waco, because they're white, nobody's wringing their hands over the white community, and its culpability in those actions overall.
Talking to Aram Sinreich, he's an assistant professor at Rutgers University, talking about media coverage of violence in different communities. We'll go back to our callers with Christine in Superior. Christine, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I am from rural Wisconsin, northernmost point in Superior, and bordering Duluth, Minnesota. And there is definitely, in this town, these two towns, a glaring disparity between the way whites and blacks are treated by the police. And I don't know if that is because we are so rural and not as diverse, or if there's more to it than that, but I have dealt with it, every day, day in and day out. From the time I was young, I've lived through my whole life, right up until a nonviolent domestic disturbance with me and my ex. And I actually had to hire an attorney to fight four felony counts. And mind you, this was a nonviolent offense. I had no prior record. I was a full-time college student and a mother. And I was facing four felonies. I don't know of a domestic disturbance where that happens with whites, but I'm sure maybe it does. I hope.
Christine, I want to ask, are you African American yourself?
I am half, actually. I'm half white and half black, so I feel like I have a great perspective on both sides of the fence, because I don't really fit in either place. I'm really not sometimes perceived by certain blacks as not black enough, and by whites as, I'm not white, so I don't fit there either.
Christine, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Aram in on this while we still have time. She's saying this, far from the big cities we've been talking about, this permeates daily society. It maybe also permeates the media, Aram.
Yeah, I think it does. And you know, there's been ample research done on the media framing of violence from a racial perspective. And it all really points to this overarching, you know, top to bottom, inside to outside, implicit bias in the way that we frame and cover the stories. And it does leak into people's lives, like this poor woman, where the police in her town probably were more primed for a violent encounter in her case than in her neighbor's case, because maybe they perceived her as being non-white. I mean, I can't speak to those specifics, but again, the research points to overarching bias in the media framing, but also overarching unconscious bias in the actions of police officers. And by the way, this is just as true of police officers of color as it is of white officers. They both behave in a way that is consistently biased against citizens of color. And, you know, this is a national problem, and I'm actually really relieved that we're beginning to have this conversation, because it's not like it began with Trayvon Martin or with Ferguson. This has been going on since before the Civil War.
We'll take another caller now. Thanks for that, Christine. We've got Malia in Winona, Minnesota now. Malia, hi.
Hi. I just want to make a point. We're talking about reading through what we write and being very sensitive to what we write, but do you understand that motorcycles clubs are clubs? They are not gangs. And we keep referring to all of these clubs as gangs, and it's very offensive.
What's the distinction, Malia?
What is the distinction? It's a distinction that they are not a gang. They are a club. And that's how they refer to themselves, and that's how they prefer to be seen, is a club, not a gang.
Malia, thanks for the call. And maybe she's leaning toward more the legal operating motorcycle clubs as opposed to these outfits that were in this shootout in Waco that are also criminal enterprises. A distinction worth making, motorcycle club versus gang?
Yeah, I actually do think it's an important distinction, and thank you for raising that point. I think the more clinical we are in the language that we use to discuss violence, the less room there is for bias to creep in. And I agree with the caller. I don't think the word gang actually serves any purpose. I think it's so vague that it can be used to cover a broad range of different organizations and activities and therefore is valueless. My understanding is that in this case, these particular motorcycle clubs were engaged in organized crime. That's the impression that I get from reading the news coverage fairly closely, but I could be wrong. I haven't looked at the legal proceedings here. If they were engaged in organized crime, then I think gang would be a more appropriate term to use, even despite the vagueness that we were talking about before.
Malia, thanks for that call. And Aram, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Aram Sinreich. He's an assistant professor at Rutgers University's School of Communication and Information, talking about potential bias in the media coverage of white crime versus black crime in the wake of the shootings in Waco, Texas.